The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bryan, Judge Smith, Judge Rudenberg, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Bryan presiding. This case is A210203, State of Minnesota versus Alonzo Lonnie Jr. Williams.
Well, good morning to you, and thank you for participating today remotely. And although we're not in person, we'll proceed under the same rules as if we were still at the Judicial Center. And I will note that the proceedings are being audio recorded. So if you would please state your name and the party that you represent before you begin your argument, that way we will be able to link those up appropriately. I also want to make a couple of additional notes. Since we're using this video conferencing platform, you may be in your home or somewhere that interruptions or technical difficulties might happen. We will try to be understanding and accommodate those and ensure that you have all the time to which you're entitled. If you have a doorbell or pets or family members that interrupt, I hope you won't be overly anxious about that because we understand that sometimes those things do happen. And I also want to make sure you understand that you can see the clock that shows how much time you have remaining for your argument. It's easier to see it if you're in gallery view as opposed to the active speaker view. So if you want to toggle your view so that it's showing the gallery, that way you'll be able to see the clock for sure. And last, only the attorneys and the judges are permitted to speak. We've disabled the ability of other participants on the video call to share their audio or video or to make comments in the chat function. All right. And if at any time you are not able to see somebody or hear one of us, please just let us know right away and we will take whatever action we need to make sure that everybody can hear each other. And with that, why don't we turn to Mr. Luzzo?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Adam Lozo, and I represent the appellant Alonzo Williams, Jr. I'd like to start by focusing my argument on why Mr. Williams' kidnapping conviction must be reversed, before turning to other issues in the case if time allows. There's no question that removing or confining someone without his or her consent is unlawful behavior. The question this court must answer is whether the evidence was sufficient to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the specific offense the state chose to charge Mr. Williams with committing, kidnapping for the purpose of terrorizing the victim. The choice to charge that particular offense placed upon the state the burden to prove not only that Mr. Williams removed the victim without his consent, but also an additional element, that the removal was done for the specific purpose of terrorizing the victim. That is, the state had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the removal was done for the specific purpose of causing extreme fear by use of violence or threats, which is the definition of terrorize. The state did not prove here that mental element. There was no harm inflicted or attempted to be inflicted upon Baker during the removal, the victim, and no threats made to the victim at all during the removal. Given that there was no violence committed upon the victim during the removal, no threats made to him during the removal, and no attempt to do either thing, one reasonable inference, a very reasonable inference, is that the removal was not specifically intended to threaten him or cause him harm or to inflict fear.
Mr. Yes. Lozo, you're separating the removal from the injury that was inflicted before the removal?
Certainly, Your Honor. So the kidnapping statute specifically requires that the state has to prove the purpose for the removal. The injury that was inflicted before, as Mr. Williams conceded at trial, constituted a fifth degree assault. That happened before the removal conduct, which is what the state has to prove was intended to cause him terror. So as Mr. Williams conceded at trial, the prior conduct of hitting and harming the victim constituted a fifth degree assault. But the subsequent conduct of removing him is what the state had to prove was intended to terrorize him. And during that conduct, there was no infliction of harm upon Mr. Baker. There was no violent conduct toward the victim. There was no threat made to him during that time. And what the state had to prove was that conduct, the removal, the purpose of that was to terrorize the victim. And here, this is not a situation where there's no other potential explanation for why the removal occurred, as might be the case if in some other circumstances. Here, Mr. Williams made clear during the entire incident what was on his mind during this incident. He was trying to figure out whether the things that he said his girlfriend was telling him about what the front desk clerk and she had done was true. Mr. Williams brought the victim to the motel room where his girlfriend was to bring the two face to face, wherein he confronted the girlfriend with the victim. During that time, he didn't speak to the victim. He didn't say anything to the victim, certainly didn't threaten the victim. He was concerned during that period of time with bringing those two people together who had been in different parts of the motel and confronting them to see if what the things she was saying was true. As I said, during that period of time, there were no threats. There was no harm. There was no violence. The removal was done. It's very rational to conclude, given the circumstances proved, that it was done to bring those two together to initiate a confrontation, not to cause the victim of that offense to feel extreme fear by use of violence or threats, which is what
he was trying to initiate. Your theory is the alternative hypothesis is he was trying to initiate a confrontation between the clerk and his girlfriend?
Well, confrontation may not be the right word, but to initiate a meeting between the two of them, because what his girlfriend had said, what Mr. Williams reported was that his girlfriend had told him there was sexual conduct, consensual and non-consensual, between those two people, between herself and the front desk clerk. When Mr. Williams first approached the front desk, as the victim testified, he was interrogating him about that conduct.
To use force against someone, bring him to the room, accusing him of something in a very heated interpersonal matter, it seems a little far-fetched to suggest that it was just a sating of curiosity. Oh, was this the guy? Oh, interesting. Okay, now you can go back to your desk. I mean, it seems to sort of understate what one would reasonably expect a person in the employee's position to feel was going to happen in a room with a very angry boyfriend who has already committed some violence against you.
Well, Your Honor, I think that there are two things to remember in response to that question, which I do think is important. One is that even if parts of this encounter were heated, I do think it's true. It would be understating it to say, oh, just satisfying curiosity. That's not what we're arguing happened here. But even if there were parts of this confrontation that were heated, what the state had to prove was that the purpose for the removal was to inflict terror upon the victim. And the second part of your question I did want to address, or another thing that your question brought up that I wanted to address, was, if I heard you correctly, there was something to the effect of, well, might you expect that he would feel fear in this circumstance? And right.
Wouldn't one's actions reasonably lead you to believe you're terrifying that person? And isn't that then for the purpose of terrorizing?
So what the state has to prove is the purpose that Mr. Williams removed him for. What might have been a reasonably probable consequence of doing that is not proof of purpose. That's proof of a different offense element of intent, which is not the intent element that's at issue in this case. And that's an argument that the state raised in its respondent's brief. And I think it needs to be very clear that what the state needed to prove was the purpose for which Mr. Williams brought the victim to the motel room. If the purpose was not specifically to inflict terror upon the victim, the offense wasn't proven. And because the element is purpose and not just intent, it's not enough for the state simply to prove, well, it's likely that someone would feel fear in these circumstances. The state had to prove the purpose for the removal, not just the likely consequences. And I think that another thing that emphasizes that is that the jury was specifically instructed, in accordance with the law, that it wasn't enough for the state simply to prove that the victim felt fear. It's not enough to prove that the result of the conduct was fear or even terror.
I appreciate that. And I think, thank you for that. I think, but we're deciding, we have to decide, you're asking us to conclude that there was a rational other purpose here, right? Yeah. And that in light of all these circumstances, it was rational to conclude that that the purpose was not to terrorize, but instead was something else. And I think my question sort of goes to the whether it's rational, that the purpose was simply to have him come into the room and, I guess, in a way that would not be terrorizing, to have him or her or someone answer whether there was a sexual assault or other sexual conduct.
Well, Your Honor, I would just...
Go ahead.
Briefly, I would point to the circumstances proved, which are that the victim, Mr. Baker, testified that during that period of time, there were no threats made to him. The video shows that, to the extent that the video shows what happened in the hallway, shows that there was no violent conduct. Mr. Baker testified there was no harm inflicted during that period of time. So I think that all of those facts would support a rational conclusion, especially, frankly, given that earlier there had been violent conduct, when during this period of time there was no violent conduct, there were no threats. I think that it at least supports a rational inference that his purpose was not to terrorize him by use of violence or threats, given that there was no violence, there were no threats. But Judge Rodenberg, I believe you were about to ask a question.
Yeah, I feel like we may be confusing purpose with motive here in your argument. That is, it seems like he purposefully drug him down the hallway and terrorized both he and the girlfriend, but that his motive was to determine whether they had had some sexual relations. He may have had multiple purposes, and the other one was to confront the two of them in the motel room. But it seems like the statute doesn't require that it be your sole purpose to terrorize. In other words, take a different case. Someone does the same thing, hits a person, drags them on the hall, puts them in the hotel room and demands a ransom. Well, their motive was to get some money out of it. But in doing so, they purposefully took him down there and detained him.
Well, Your Honor, in your hypothetical, that would be kidnapping under the specific language of the statute, the purpose to remove, to hold for ransom. So that would be kidnapping under a different portion of the statute. But I do think one thing I do want to clarify that I would resist a bit in your framing of the element at issue is that there is no dispute that Mr. Williams intended to bring the victim down the hallway. That conduct was intentional, of bringing him down the hallway. But I would argue that what the state needs to prove is something closer to motive than simply the intent to undertake the act that he did. That would be a general intent, which is not the mens rea element for this crime. What the state had to prove, and this is in State v. Wilson, the Supreme Court specifically defined what it means to do something for the purpose of that element. And the state has to prove that the specific intent was to cause a particular result. So it's not enough just that Mr. Williams intentionally undertook the conduct of bringing the victim down the hallway, of intentionally removed him. What the state had to prove was that his specific purpose for removing him was to cause the result that that the victim be terrorized.
Well, Mr. Lozo, I'm not sure that I agree with that interpretation of the element. And I'm looking at your own brief at page 15 where you cite Wilson, but the very next cite is to an unpublished case that you cite for the point of showing that the purpose element is, and I'm quoting from your quote of this case, in the context of kidnapping, purpose is akin to intent, right? And it's that intent that transforms forced confinement or removal into the serious crime known as kidnapping. And so if purpose is akin to intent, that's a little different than how you're now arguing Wilson applies, because the intent of, as you put it, bringing him down the hall, I think other verbs are used at different points to describe the conduct of bringing him down the hall, and dragging is another word that's used. The intent is not the same as motive. And instead it's, do you intend to move a person forcibly from point A to point B? That's what intent would according to the way I'm seeing, the way you've argued it in your own brief.
Well, so the one unpublished case that you're referring to, Judge Bryan, of course,
you referred to it. I'm just noting that in your own brief, when you referred to it, you did so for a point that's inconsistent with the point that I hear you now making to Judge Rodenberg.
Well, immediately before that, Judge Brian, Wilson, the Supreme Court's precedential decision, I quoted obviously as saying, for the purpose of element requires the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant acted with the specific intent to cause a particular result. That is...
No, I understand that. I think the inconsistency as I'm hearing it is what particular result are you looking at? And in your response to Judge Rodenberg, the particular result wasn't moving someone from point A to point B or inflicting harm on somebody. The specific or particular result that you're now arguing is to have this confrontation or this meeting, to arrange a meeting out of curiosity, which isn't what is required by the statute, that the particular result required by the statute is to make someone feel intense terror. And so that's the part that I think is a little bit different. Particular result, if purpose is akin to intent, then particular result is just you intend the result of your actions.
Well, first of all, I would clarify to the extent that I quoted that portion of that case, which predates the precedential decision in interpreting purpose, that quote was done mostly to indicate that intent is what transforms the unlawful conduct that is not as serious of kidnapping to the serious offense of kidnapping, which is punishable by up to 20 years in prison, as opposed to false imprisonment, which I would argue this was not kidnapping, which is punishable by a maximum of 3. And I would urge the court not to focus on that one sort of part of an unpublished decision, and to focus more on the overall argument and the precedential decision, which is that, as you just stated, the state has to prove the purpose the purpose for the removal to cause the particular result, which the statute requires to be of causing terror. And I can address this further in rebuttal as well.
Yeah, if you could. And if you could, in rebuttal, point us to some authority where we have adopted that interpretation of the statute. In other words, where we have reversed some conduct, saying, well, the purpose wasn't to terrorize somebody. The purpose that this defendant had was to have companionship with the person that was kidnapped or allegedly kidnapped, right? And so therefore, we reverse because that's insufficient evidence. I want to see the authority that goes along with your interpretation of that statute.
Would you like me to respond very briefly to that right now, Your Honor?
Well, I think it's okay to do in rebuttal. I think that's fine. And I know we're already a little bit behind time, so I'd appreciate it if you were able to work that into rebuttal if you can. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Stockmeyer.
Morning, Your Honors. Counsel, and may it please the court, my name is Ed Stockmeyer. I'm an assistant attorney general appearing this morning on behalf of the state of Minnesota. The evidence of appellant's intent to terrorize the victim was more than sufficient. When a defendant violently assaults a person whom they did not know without warning or provocation, and then forcefully drags that person to a secluded and private motel room, the only reasonable inference that can be drawn is that the defendant intends that person to experience extreme fear, which is the definition of to terrorize. It is simply not possible to draw a reasonable inference that is inconsistent with such an intent to terrorize from those facts. The biggest problem, I think, with appellant's argument in this case is that he is simply misapplying the circumstantial evidence standard of review and how it operates in the context of specific intent. We agree with Mr. Williams' argument that specific intent requires the state to prove that the defendant acted with the intent to cause the victim to experience extreme fear. But the circumstantial evidence standard of review requires us to reject inferences that are unreasonable based on the facts of the case. So when a defendant comes into an appellate court and says, yes, I violently assaulted that person. Yes, I angrily accused them of having intercourse with my girlfriend. Yes, I then dragged them to a private motel room. But I didn't intend for them to experience fear. We have to reject that because it's an unreasonable inference to draw from those facts. So this is really just a case about applying the circumstantial evidence standard of review.
What does the evidence tell us about the taking the employee down the hall? You're saying forced him, dragged him, there's been escorted, there's been, what did the evidence tell us about that?
He had us on the video. You can see him physically pulling the victim out of the check-in area, that little enclosed check-in area. And then you can see him continuing to have his hand on the victim as they approach the motel room on the video. So
was the victim walking down it? Was the victim walking to the room?
Yes, he was on his feet. It's not as if he was off his feet dragging him, but he had his hands on him. So when my friend says that the assault ended, that we need to separate the assault from the removal, I think that's actually false factually, because there was a continuation of unlawful application of physical contact upon the victim by the defendant. And that goes into what a reasonable victim is going to interpret those actions to mean. He is continuing to force me to go where I don't want to go. He's been accusing me of having intercourse with his girlfriend. I don't know what's going to happen here. And I just think it's unreasonable for somebody to say that the defendant in those circumstances has no intention to cause the victim to experience fear. In my friend's reply brief, there's a novel statutory interpretation of the word purpose. The reply brief argues, and we heard this argument again this morning, that the word purpose imposes a more rigorous standard than what is ordinarily required for proving specific intent under Minnesota Statute Section 60902 Subdivision 9, which is the statutory definition of specific intent. My first response to that is that's a forfeited argument. There is no argument about the meaning of the word purpose as distinct from specific intent in the principal brief. It's something that was raised for the first time in the reply. And Judge Ryan, you made exactly the point that I was going to make on page 16. My friend quoted an unpublished 16 of his principal brief. My friend quoted an unpublished opinion for the proposition that purpose is akin to intent. That's exactly the opposite of what appellant is arguing this morning and what he argued in his principal brief. But even if the argument isn't forfeited, it's just wholly irreconcilable with the Supreme Court's decision in Wilson, in which the court dealt with the fleeing on foot statute, has the word purpose, and the court held that designated in that statute specific intent. And in addition, I think if we just think about some other offenses, say assault fear, I think we all agree that assault fear requires the state prove that the defendant acted for the specific purpose of causing the victim to experience a fear of imminent harm. And so that's no different than what my friend is advocating for the word purpose. They mean the same thing.
So Mr. Stockmeyer, can I ask, because I also noticed some tension between the two arguments related, I think, to the robbery and then the kidnapping. Is it your argument that purpose and intent are equivalent terms, and that when there's for the purpose of, it's a specific intent crime, and then therefore circumstantial evidence rule applies unless there's some direct evidence of intent?
So, Your Honor, let me address that at a couple levels, because I think it's a bit of a layered question. So, yes, our position is purpose and intent are coextensive, that purpose indicates a specific intent. That's what the court held in Wilson. The argument we have in our robbery case is, actually, let me back up. I disagree with you, your question, to the extent that there's a suggestion that if there's an element of specific intent required, that automatically the circumstantial evidence standard of review applies. You can have direct evidence.
Right. I said absent direct evidence. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I must have missed that. I apologize, Your Honor. But our position on the robbery issue is simply just that the case appellant relies on, Townsend, was dealing with a specific intent element. And the court applied the traditional standard for reviewing the sufficiency of the evidence. I agree. To be honest, when I read that opinion, I was surprised about that. I think ordinarily when we talk about those sort of facts, would be applying the circumstantial evidence standard of review. But it is nonetheless indisputable that the Supreme Court elected not to apply that standard of review.
And prior to Townsend, was that a specific intent crime, the simple robbery? Or did Townsend change the law and make it specific? I know we're going away from the kidnapping and robbery situation now, but I'm trying to understand what you think the law is around that and what the right standard of review is in a simple case.
So I think the right standard of review is under what the court said in Townsend, which is whether the jury could reasonably conclude that the element had been proved. As far as the state of the law before Townsend, Townsend didn't treat itself as adopting a new rule of law. Townsend cited precedent from this court, the Stanifer case, cited a couple other cases. And so I don't think it was changing the law in any material way. I recognize the tension here, but I'm really just applying Townsend as the Supreme Court did. And I think, you know, as I noted in the brief, I think if we're going to rely on Townsend, we're sort of stuck with that decision and with what the Supreme Court did there.
Even if in that case the appellant didn't argue a circumstantial evidence standard of review, you're saying because the Supreme Court applied direct, even if evidence standard of review, even if that's argued, that we're all bound by it, even though it would be in tension with the normal standard of review for an intent.
Your Honor, the issue in front of the court in Townsend was the evidence sufficient? And the Supreme Court held that the evidence was sufficient because the jury could reasonably conclude that the element had been proved. I think really what appellant is arguing is that this court ought to just disregard what the Supreme Court did in Townsend because appellant thinks the court made a mistake. I think that's really at the heart of the argument. And I just disagree with that. I, as an advocate, all I can do is apply the rules that the Supreme Court applies in its holdings. So unless this court has any further questions, I would simply just ask that this court affirm the convictions. Thank you.
I guess I have one further question. You're arguing, I think, that the circumstances that should be looked at are those that preceded, I think, you know, taking the employee down the hall. The circumstances that occurred afterwards, like in the room, there wasn't threats or anything directed to him or any further attacks, et cetera. I mean, should that also be taken into account in determining whether there's a rational hypothesis that the purpose was not to terrorize? Because, look, in fact, there wasn't any terrorizing done when he's in the room.
Well, Your Honor, it may be the case that at some point the victim realized, okay, this is going to end okay for me. But we have to look at the defendant's intent the whole way. I mean, kidnapping began to occur when he started to remove the victim from the check-in area. I think I'd also point out the fact that the defendant had accused the victim of sleeping with his girlfriend, and then he brought the victim to encounter his girlfriend. Those are exceptionally frightening circumstances, especially when it's immediately following a violent assault. And I think any defendant who acts in that way intends that victim to feel extreme fear. So again, we simply just ask this court to affirm the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lozo.
Thank you, Your Honor. In response to the question you posed at the end of my first portion about the direct authority, I can't point you to a case with these same facts where this court reversed. Of course, the court should apply the generally applicable law to these facts. And as we've argued, reverse the kidnapping conviction. I do want to respond a little bit to the forfeiture claim and to the idea that this is a different argument than was made in the principal brief. The argument in the principal brief was that the state had to prove his specific purpose for the removal was to inflict terror upon the victim. That's the argument throughout the principal brief. In response, the state brought up the argument that, well, it's enough if we prove that him feeling terror was a natural and probable consequence of the removal. And in doing so, the state relied on intent cases, not purpose cases. The Supreme Court has said in Wilson that specific intent to cause a particular result is purpose. So specific intent to cause a particular result is purpose. That does not mean that intent and purpose are equivalent. You can just look to the definition of intent in the statute, which says that intent means either purpose or knowledge that your acts will bring about a particular result. So under the statute, those two states of mind are not equivalent. Purpose is specific intent to bring about the particular result of terror, which is what the state had to prove in this case. I would like to turn briefly to the robbery issue as well, because it got discussed a little bit there at the end. And I do want to say, regarding the direct versus circumstantial standard on proving Mr. Williams' intent to commit robbery, I'm not quite sure where the state was going with the argument here. I think that Judge Smith, you hit on the correct answer, which is that in Townsend, they didn't apply the circumstantial standard, because in Townsend, the defendant had not only not contested whether the circumstantial standard applied, but had conceded that he had committed attempted robbery. And so there was no need for the state, for the court to apply the circumstantial standard, because the defendant was arguing he was guilty of attempted robbery, and therefore that intent element was fulfilled. He argued that he didn't achieve the particular result that the statute required, which is what the Supreme Court rejected when it decided that that on the intent element in Townsend. But the only reason that the circumstantial standard wasn't applied in that case was because no one argued it had to be, and because the defendant had conceded it didn't need to be. And so in this case, where you don't have direct evidence of what Mr. Williams' purpose for using force behind the counter was, this court does have to apply the circumstantial standard to determine whether his purpose was to commit robbery. And as he did in the hotel room, during that period of time, he was talking to the victim about the girlfriend, not about wanting to take property or anything like that. And so because the circumstances proved don't lead unerringly to the conclusion that his purpose was for using force was to take property, the evidence was insufficient to prove the robbery offense as well. So does the court, I would like to ask the court if the court has any questions on any of the claims, and in particular to follow up on the kidnapping claim if there are continued questions on that. So in conclusion, we would just ask this court to reverse Mr. Williams' convictions, and we would ask the court to reverse. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for your arguments and for your written submissions. We'll take the matter under advisement. And